Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, writer Louise Erdrich on returning to a novel she thought at one point might be lost. It's a story in a style, speculative fiction, that's rather different than most of Louise Erdrich's other novels. And some of the most disturbing themes of the novel evoke frightening classics from George Orwell and Margaret Atwood. In an author's note at the beginning of the book, Louise writes, "Writing this work of speculative fiction felt like writing a form of truth." Louise's new novel is titled Future Home of the Living God, and she joins me in the studio. And welcome back. So good to see you.
Thank
as always.
Thank you, Carrie. It's great to be here. Hello, everyone.
Happy publication day, too. So that's great.
Did you say complication day or publication day?
Both, I think, in the life of a novelist like you, right? So before we talk about the politics and the themes of the novel, I'm really interested in what happens when someone with the experience that you have as a writer unearths a kind of time capsule, because in some ways, this was that, right? You'd started it you'd put it away. Talk to me about that.
It was. So I started this book in 2002, and I started it when the global gag rule was being signed by George W. Bush.
Family planning, aid.
Oh, across the globe, depriving absolutely destitute women of female health and reproductive services all over the world. And it infuriated me on a level that I didn't know how to deal with, so I began to write this book. And it became dystopian, I suppose dystopian. I didn't even think of it as dystopian. I thought of it as a sort of realistic scenario where, yes, reproductive rights were not only removed, but as the novel went on, and you know, I'm interested in evolution, so I just thought, what happened if it stops? We don't know why it started. How about stopping it and seeing what happens in fiction? Well, I got sort of overwhelmed with what would happen to women who were pregnant, and I began to write this world where women who were pregnant were incarcerated so that their babies could be adequately studied. And then I had, I wrote a piece where in a Minneapolis shopping mall, a woman gets hunted down and arrested because she's pregnant.
And again, this is all in 2002.
This was
You're
in 2002.
This. Okay.
And
what made you put it away for a while?
Well, other books came along, and then Obama was elected. Things began to look a bit brighter for women's reproductive health.
It didn't seem as urgent, some of the themes and ideas.
And also, I began to find, you know, I'm a short attention span person, except that once I get going with something, I go deeply into it.
Uh-huh.
So other things captured my attention, and I wanted to work on The Roundhouse, which is about sexual violence, the difficulty of prosecuting on reservation land, mm-hmm. and other books came up. So fast forward to November of last year, and I'm working on a book that I think I'm completely absorbed with. The election happens, and I can do nothing but search for this old manuscript, which is trapped in an iMac.
That's why I said it's a time capsule,
right? That's what we're talking about, the time capsule, because thank God I had a friend, and then I had my daughter, Pallas, who started resurrecting this manuscript that was digital gibberish. and put it back into words and format. Thank God it was gone for
a
while.
So this is kind of my original question then. What happens when you open a book that is, you know, back from your life and your thinking 12 years, 13 years before that?
Yeah.
And you read what you wrote then. So what do you start to understand about yourself? And
I understood that we had come a distance. There was social progress that we'd made. I had, in the book, I had a sort of rudimentary view of, I didn't have any, there was something that was missing in the book that it was just not there. You know, that things were different in some ways. You know, we have same-sex marriage. We've made some big leaps.
Uh-huh.
But in other ways, it was deja vu all over again. It was right there. And then, of course, the first thing Trump does is sign the global gag rule. And from there, we also have seen the erosion of women's reproductive rights here in the United States. Texas, can you get an abortion? No. North Dakota, slim chance. All sorts of places have become kind of like they've lost this essential right that women have.
I also want to mention that when President Trump signed this order, it went even further than President George
W.
Bush's,
yes.
Right?
So it did.
So this is and you say about this in your author's note, it's a policy that will be, quote, largely invisible to the American public. Why?
We haven't heard a thing. And women are dying, are maimed, are mutilated, are women who are unable to give birth, and not to speak of contending with the progeny of rapists or incest. You know, that's not even in the picture. This is a world not that far from the dystopia depicted in this book. It's a real world.
You know what's interesting about that is I think when you use the word dystopian, and I saw your hesitation a minute ago, we tend to think so far in the future, it's much removed from the reality of the world that we're living in today. But what you're saying is, and you've set the novel just actually, what, a few months into the future?
That's why I don't know that I can call it a dystopia.
Exactly.
It's set as though this could happen tomorrow in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or it could happen in 50 years. I mean, there's an ambiguous time that it's set in. But the reality is this chase scene, which would be comical if it wasn't so horrible. I've been pregnant 4 times, and each time I felt this increasing claustrophobia, this helplessness. I mean, it was, you know, I had this lucky, beautiful pregnancies, but at the same time, there's no denying the fact that being pregnant means that you become extremely dependent. And by the end, you can hardly move. And so I have this, my hero is being chased down, a pregnant woman being chased down by, you know, these forces that seem, there's a chaotic sense of where she's supposed to go, what she's supposed to do, because things have broken down. But there's one person who seems on her trail, and that is Mother. We have to talk about her.
Who is the creepiest character, who really only appears a few times. I found Mother to be one of the creepiest characters of the whole novel.
Oh, thank you, Carrie.
What? That's,
she's
that's
based,
a compliment.
She's based on someone, she's based on Karen Pence.
Really?
She is.
The wife of the vice president?
The wife of the vice president.
How so?
Because I think we don't really, because we're so overwhelmed. There's so much coming out. There's so much chaos. We really haven't examined who's in the position should Trump be impeached. Or, I mean, let's be honest, he's only like a chocolate cake clogged artery away from having Pence step into that place.
Uh-huh.
I hope people go and look at who Pence is and who Karen Pence is.
And so Karen Pence represents for you this warm, I mean, mother in the novel is
of
an inviting,
of course,
warm, caring.
Yes.
Yes.
And warm, slime is warm. You know, she is out to control and administer birth to every woman possible, because apparently no one knows whether babies are viable. So this, to me, this mother here is the face of women who are co-opted into this sense of control, that they have to control other women's reproduction. And that, to me, is, it's almost, it's so dispiriting, because I want to be, my gravity draws me to other women as a force of good and understanding, right, and intelligence about these subjects. So what infuriates me is when women are co-opted into this role and decide that they should control other women.
You know, I'm listening and watching you talk about this. We talked about every novel in your, what, Justice trilogy.
Yeah.
Right? And you came in with a lot of determination and, I think, outrage about the themes at the center of those novels. But I don't know that you've ever been so fired up, I guess, about making sure that the message of a novel is not lost.
We've never been in this situation.
Is that how you feel?
I do. I felt it from day one. And I think that is the feeling so many people have with this administration. There is a reason that suddenly novels about authoritarianism, about a, you know, dystopic novels became crucial reading for people, and it's because there's this sense that with just one day's notice, we could be living in one of these novels, and we see the signs of it all the time, and for women, that would be very simple. I mean, we have a kind of, because of our biology, we have a kind of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it's the role of older women to try their best to protect younger women from a world where they really can be so vulnerable, and try to protect women who don't have resources, and try to protect women whose health is at stake.
You know, when you talk about this wave of dystopian novels, and again, we've just said, does this really fit into that? Because it's not what I would consider to be the full definition
really,
of dystopia.
Exactly.
But I think it's interesting to think about the evolution of where those dystopian novels have been. I mean, we started off with a wave, and this happened during the last administration, during the Obama administration, but this wave of zombies and where, you know, that kind of figure of dystopian, the one that you're writing about seems more, in a sense, the maturing of the idea of dystopia and where the novel fits. What do you think?
Well, I think that women have this capacity for understanding, and it's, you know, it's not that men won't understand this, but women face a vast physical change, and that's what she talks about in this novel. You know, she's writing this to her baby. I also felt like it was important that I could write a character who was able to celebrate and exalt in having a baby while this crazy world was changing around her. And while obviously she was living out the ultimate anti-choice world, the ultimate in, well, it's not even a, you know, I always feel like religion is a mask that allows people to control other people, right? The religious rules. I think there's a whole difference between spirituality and religious rules. Religious rules generally include some form of controlling women's reproduction. And so she's living with all of that, state control, religious control, not so much, but state control of reproduction. Where were we? Oh, my goodness. I'm just going into this.
Louise Erdrich. This tends to happen when we start to talk.
Well, actually, you know, part of it was, I have to say, it was entertaining to write because it was this chase scene. And a woman getting bigger and bigger, being chased, being the hero. And how is this going to work out? And researching all the scenes throughout the Twin Cities. I mean, I have the Wabasha Caves.
There's a comic component to this, Louise.
This mall, which I exactly know where it is. It's in St. Paul, and where there's arrests happening, and the house that she survives in. You know, all these places.
Louise Erdrich is in the studio with us, and we're talking about her novel, Out Today, Future Home of the Living God. You've heard a little bit about the genesis of the novel, begun in 2002 on various different kinds of computers that made it hard to extract it when she came back to it after the Trump election last year. If you'd like to join the conversation, some observations about what we're talking about, that's cool too. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Jill in River Falls called to say, I want to thank Louise and thank NPR for having her on. The statements she's making are so encouraging and empowering. You saw in the wake of the Trump election, the Women's March, a lot of activism, a lot of gathering, and that's still going on in communities, even though there hasn't been another march organized. There's a lot of activism among women happening.
Yes.
I've heard women say, you know, in some ways we might have been asleep or pacified, and this awakened us and activated us again, and that was necessary. What do you think?
Well, I think that's true, but I still wouldn't take Trump to activate us. You know, I really can't say that, because it's more than us. Of course, we're being laughed out of the climate, the climate summit,
the United Nations climate.
Absolutely, summit. You know, the embarrassment and the way that. We're going to see a further degradation. We're not going to make any progress on controlling climate change. You know, this is really tremendously crucial. And by the end of this book, it also is about climate change. I didn't know exactly how to put it, but a lot is going to happen because of the changing temperature in the world. And we don't know. We don't know what if evolution had something to do with the temperature of the world. That's really far-fetched. But we do know, and by the end, we do know that at some point, if we don't control it, we won't have winter. We won't have any winter. You know, we're going toward the climate of New Orleans. That's where we're going. And so we have to think about that.
You know, you've mentioned evolution again. I'm interested in how you thought about what it would mean to not just arrest evolution, but have it move backwards. I mean, how invested in the science of that were you, or was that really just a, you know, a literary device?
It was both. I mean, I'm fascinated with fossils and dead ends and evolutionary. I'm reading right now about how it's called How Beauty Evolves. It's a wonderful book. And
how our idea of what beauty is evolved?
Our idea of beauty is
symmetry, isn't it?
Well, it's evolved through mate selection. So women, I mean, really birds. We're talking really about birds to sort of give the example. But mate selection in birds is called
you just pulled a note out of your
pocket.
I
had to, because I get nervous when I'm talking to you, Carrie. I can't remember everything. The Evolution of Beauty, and it's Darwin's theory of mate selection and how it shapes the animal world and us. It's by Richard Prum.
Okay.
And I was fascinated with evolution, and technological evolution played its part by going way faster than I thought,
right?
And trapping my manuscript, but I also in 2002 there was a lot more about evolution in the news. I mean, by people who are evolution deniers. At this point, that seems like a small concern, right? I mean, we're thinking about some other very big concerns. But I've always been fascinated with it. My first outings were fossil hunts. You know, I love that.
And yet, as you're saying this, I'm thinking where climate, I mean, I've done shows with scientists who say what's happening with climate change is absolutely affecting, is interfering with evolution.
Yes.
So
you're
asking where this,
it's
where
changing.
They meet.
It absolutely is, and it's been human activity has been changing evolution since we began to be a force on this planet. So this is not so far fetched, but I did want to stop it and see what happened and have it maybe go backward, because that is the sense I had, this sliding sense of going backwards in 2002, and then this sliding sense of going backward in 2016. It was a kind of retrograde motion. It's like vection. It's like this feeling that you have when you're standing still, but the train is going, is moving next to you, and you have that uneasy sense of motion, and you don't quite know where you're going.
Right.
And that's the sense that I have on some level.
You have a sense that solid ground isn't as solid as you thought it was.
That's right.
That what's under your feet is malleable in some
ways. Yeah, I think we've all had that sense. And there also have been, I mean, I thought it was interesting that you led in with talk about Roy Moore, mm-hmm. and with this critical mass of women coming forward to talk about abuse and to talk about harassment and to really put it out there. You know, this is a form of progress for women. So there's pieces of progress being made even as we slide backwards. We're on shifting ground.
But you also heard what I said in that interview about confirmation bias. I mean, that's also the environment that we're living in, from a journalistic standpoint, the facts don't matter as much as I hang on to what I believe, and mm-hmm. the evidence about that is not going to open my mind to that. And I understand that about politics, but it seems like what you were talking about with vection, it just seems unsteady.
Unsteady.
Hard to figure it out.
Well, I think part of what is destabilized is our information is not subject to the fairness doctrine, mm-hmm. which was revoked in, 87? And since then, we've had just a proliferation of idea centers in the media where you can only listen to your own ideas. I know this is well-trammeled ground, but mm-hmm. I think we have to talk about bringing back some balance, bringing back a fairness doctrine.
You've made a point, I think, of saying that this is speculative, not science fiction, and that's something that Margaret Atwood talks about too. Why? What different? Why not call it science fiction?
Well, because it's there's no science really to back up the speculations that you use in fiction, so you need not to really say, I have based this on a science that tells us that evolution is going to stop. You know, mm-hmm. there's no science to base that upon. And there's no science to base a lot of speculative fiction upon which you can base much of speculative fiction. So I prefer that term. Also, I think that it leaves out a lot of wonderful books that, like Ishiguro's The Buried Giant, that don't have science in them, mm-hmm. but go into worlds that we really, and Murakami's books that bring us into worlds that maybe are not science-based, but based in some form of sensory experience, like we were talking about, vection or retrograde motion, something that we feel but we can't quite speak about, and sometimes writers can put that into words.
I got the sense in reading, again, the evolution of how the book came to be, mm-hmm. that there was, when you thought of it, after the Trump election, you thought, I have this book buried in this technology, and I need to extract it and figure that out.
Yeah.
Was it 500 pages then?
It was huge. It was okay. Huge, yeah.
As you describe that, there's this feeling of momentum in a way that when you've talked about writing your other books, that wasn't how it felt. That you just felt this kind of urgency to take away and finish and put it out. Am I projecting that onto
Not
you?
Not at all, because it wasn't finished. It was way overwritten, and I'd gotten bogged down in a lot of Catholic doctrine. You know, as
there is
I
a
tend
lot of
to
Catholic
do.
Doctrine.
Oh,
in
it's
this,
just a
which was delightful.
It's a minuscule fraction of what was in there.
Really,
I had a whole Cedar's very Catholic, and she's working on a magazine called Zeal, and I had the whole magazine in the book. So. There's another.
You did.
I did. And I think we're thinking of putting it at the end of the paperback, because some of the papers that I wrote submitting under various Catholic theologians, I mean, they were just out there. And so once I cut those away, there was a lot of action. So I kept that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you... I don't know what your process is like with your other novels. I know you feel an urgency around the idea at the center of it, but did this feel like it swept you in some ways in the writing of it that you haven't felt in other books?
It felt like I could think when I wrote this book. I couldn't.
Okay, what does that
I couldn't
mean?
Think. What does that mean? I mean that something was so deep. I was so deeply disturbed on some level, and I was terribly disappointed in so many things. I needed to work on something that reflected my fears, my disappointments, and also this. This sense of being chased. I wasn't being chased, but I really understand from living my life as a woman how easy it is to be trapped by your biology, and how ruthless the assault has been upon us. So I couldn't put it down. I'm trying to think of what, and I also was sort of obsessed with this. We're mentioning all these various ways of describing things that are happening to us intellectually and emotionally, and changing baseline syndrome is one thing that I noticed happening all through Minnesota, where it's winter, it's cold, but when when I moved back, I mean, I grew up in North Dakota, and I moved back here, we had 40 below winters where, you know, you'd go through a week where it was 40 below and schools were closed down. This was what winter was and what it is naturally. We don't have that anymore. We have warmer and warmer winters, but they're still cold. So people are like, oh, it's so great.
It's the adjusting.
We're adjusting.
Right, and
it's like we think this is normal now. But of course it isn't. It's not that I love 40 below, but that's what it has to be Minnesota or to be North Dakota. And we don't have that. So it means that we're warming up very quickly.
Louise, happy Publication Complication Day.
I was supposed to mention that I'm giving a...
I will mention this.
Thank you. This is good.
Louise Erdrich's new book, tonight at 7 o'clock at St. Paul's Church on Lake of the Isles in Minneapolis. Tickets are available at Birch Bark, and there are just a few seats left. Well, I always look forward... So please write another novel very soon, and I look forward to seeing you on that.
I'm going to pick up the other one. Yes.
Ah, we didn't talk about that.
Thank you.
Louise Erdrich's novel is called Future Home of the Living God, and you can read more about it on The Thread.